We've got delinquent Dave Gilroy here, but he's probably lost. Our Father, thank you very much for our time together today. I just know my brothers have been extremely busy all day long, and it's hard to set aside the cares of the world and come together and meet with you around the Bible. But we want you to focus us on the Lord Jesus now and on this incredible Gospel of Matthew. Today, chapters 8 and 9. We have been taking two chapters a week, which is high speed, and lots and lots of content here. And this is only one of the four Gospels, and the Gospels do not all put things in the same order, as we'll see. Last time we finished the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus spoke to his disciples and to a great crowd, and he gave them what amounts to an intensification of the Law of Moses, which should get right down to the core of people's motives and their our attempts to live up to the demands of the law without changed hearts and so on. And then the sermon closes with a bunch of very practical and insightful comments on various subjects. Now, chapter 8, when he had come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. Remember, the Sermon on the Mount is not up on a mountain, it's up on a hill in a big amphitheater, which you can visit today in Galilee at the north end of the Sea of Galilee. There's a big natural amphitheater, and the crowd would have gathered on the grass as in a big amphitheater, sitting on the grass and listening to Jesus, and without a PA system, the natural setting of the amphitheater would have enabled everybody to listen to him. So we don't know whether he had 100 or 1,000 people there. And later on, we find that Jesus meets with groups of 3,000, 5,000 people. So there's a lot of people here, and these are the people that are attracted to him and attracted magnetically by his personality and by what he said. And these are the common people in Israel. This is not the sophisticated aristocratic Jews in Jerusalem. These are just plain ordinary people. Kind of people that would go to a Billy Graham crusade today. But this is a very diverse group of people ethnically, because they're Jews and Romans and Gentiles all mixed together. And great multitudes followed him. So Jesus is a very popular, charismatic person, not only by what he taught, but by everything that he did. So his lifestyle was utterly amazing. And the first thing that happens is in verse 2, behold, a leper came and worshipped him, saying, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus put out his hand and touched him, saying, I am willing, be cleansed. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. This is not the only time that Jesus healed a leper. Leprosy was extremely serious in ancient Israel, so serious that lepers had to be ostracized outside of the town. They had to live as outcasts because of the contagiousness of the leprosy, which is a skin infection. If leprosy today is the same as what we call Hansen's disease, we've almost eradicated it from the earth. There used to be leper colonies in Louisiana, and a leper colony on one of the Hawaiian islands where
Molokai, I think.
Molokai. And the skin disease called leprosy can be easily cured with antibiotics today. So once people were treated with antibiotics, leprosy was no longer a very dangerous disease. Now, the leprosy in the Old Testament may have been a much more serious illness. The Law of Moses prescribed how to treat leprosy. It was a very long, complicated series of things you had to do in Leviticus that tells you step by step how to deal with leprosy, how to heal it, how the priest can heal it, how to protect people from catching it, and how to let the leper back into the community of ordinary clean people. So we talk about moral lepers today as people that we don't want to get near or we don't want to have anything to do with because we're afraid we'll catch their sin, whatever that is. So lepers are very much looked down on in Israel, and they're shunned. And in a big crowd, a leper can walk through the crowd and get away with it. And this leper comes up to Jesus and worships him, which is pretty startling because a leper would ordinarily be such an outcast that he would never pray or ask or come up and show respect for Jesus. So this man knows who Jesus is, and he makes a request saying, if you are willing, you can make me clean. And that means that this man, whoever he is, knows that Jesus is the Messiah and that he can cure leprosy, which the doctors can't cure, which the priests can't cure. And Jesus doesn't get him into a conversation and inquire about his background and his history. Jesus just immediately, reading the man's heart, cures him, heals him on the spot. And this is a direct miracle of God. And of course, Jesus knows the man's heart, he knows his man's history, and he knows the man's worship is genuine. It's not hypocritical. He's not pretending to be looking for healing. And he also knows that Jesus is able to heal him. And so he just simply asked Jesus. And Jesus put out his hand and touched him. I am willing, be cleansed. Immediately his leprosy was cleansed. Now, that did not mean that he could put on a new set of clothes and come back into the synagogue and be accepted by the people. Jesus said, see that you tell no one, but go your way and show yourself to the priest and offer the priest the gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them. So Jesus gives this guy some homework to do. He's healed. He doesn't have leprosy anymore, but he should go to the priest and have the priest certify that he's free of leprosy. This is like going to the doctor and having blood tests and having examination and according to Leviticus, and the priest can say, well, this man is not a leper anymore. There's not a trace of leprosy. He's not contagious anymore. And Jesus wants people to know that this man is clean and acceptable in the community and that he doesn't have to be ostracized anymore. Jesus says one more thing here. He says, see that you tell no one. And that's probably because Jesus wants to keep his fame as low a profile as possible. He does not want a lot of PR. He doesn't want a lot of people running around talking about him because that will come to the attention of the scribes and Pharisees in Jerusalem who already hate his guts and are already out to get him. So this is just good crowd control, damage control on the part of the Lord.
Lambert, I noticed here in verse 3 it says, then Jesus put out his hand and touched him. You know, like
that's very good.
Yeah. So
to touch a leper would be unthinkable for a devout Jew because merely touching a leper would make you ceremonial unclean, and leprosy's contagious, so you don't even touch a leper. We get around some pretty dirty, raunchy alcoholic drunks, and I think we all want to be aloof from them. We don't want to hug them or touch them. We don't want to have anything to do with them until they've had a shower and cleaned up. Yeah. But Jesus runs right out and he touches them. And the crowd would have been horrified at this. But that didn't stop Jesus. He's not afraid. And he also knows that he's not going to get leprosy. And he also knows that touching shows compassion and concern for somebody. When you identify with them, meet them on their level, then that's compassion. And that's a good point, Dave, that you brought that up. So that's that little vignette. Now, there's a later time when Jesus heals four lepers. It's a beautiful story later on in the Gospels where Jesus heals four lepers and tells them all four to go to the priest. And only one of those lepers comes back to Jesus to thank him afterwards. So there are a lot of people that want to be healed, but they don't want to have Jesus involved in their lives. But that's another story. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, Capernaum is the town that he's staying at, the north end of the Sea of Galilee. It's where Peter lives, and Jesus has made his home in the house of Peter. It's his headquarters. He has come down from Nazareth, where he grew up, down 700-800 feet below sea level to the shores of Galilee, and he's in Capernaum, and he's staying at Peter's house, and that's his kind of campaign headquarters. He doesn't own a house. He never did. He doesn't have any property. He's dependent on handouts for food, and come time to go to bed, he's just going to curl up and sleep on the corner of the floor or whatever. And now, a Roman centurion comes up to him. Now, the Israel is under Roman control. Romans are there to preserve law and order, and also the Jews are not allowed to govern themselves because they're too ornery and difficult and divisive. And so the Romans govern with force. A centurion is a sergeant who has about 100 men under him. That's where you get the word a century or a centurion. So this guy is a respectable, Gentile, non-Jewish foreigner, and he's a good guy. He's there for crowd control. He's like a law enforcement, like a policeman or somebody that, but he's not Jewish. And this guy knows enough about Jesus. Jesus is Jewish. He knows that Jesus is not a Gentile, that Jesus has come to the Jews, not to the Gentiles. This man, however, recognizes that Jesus is a good man. And this centurion has a servant. All centurions had a servant. If you were that important in the Roman army, you would have a manservant to clean up your tent, to get your meals, to be your bodyguard, to be your right-hand man. And this servant would be very loyal and trustworthy. You depend on him to protect your life, to make sure that you're not poisoned, to make sure that your uniforms are pressed and your boots are shined and all that. And so this guy has been following Jesus, this centurion, and he's very upset. The centurion is upset because his servant is paralyzed and tormented, probably tormented by demons, we don't know, and his life is in danger. And he does not know where to go for help among his fellow Romans. He can't go to his commander, who would not take him seriously, but he goes to Jesus. Jesus said, "I will come and heal him." So Jesus says, "Okay, I have some time off. I will go to your headquarters where everybody's camped out. The Romans camped in tents. We don't know where their camp was." But Jesus says, "Okay, I'll come over to your house and I will heal him." And this is unthinkable for Jesus to stop what he's doing, serving the Jews, and go off to see some Roman soldier, hated by the Jews generally, and thoroughly pagan. But Jesus says, okay, I'll come to your house. I'll come over and visit your servant. And the centurion says, "Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word, and my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to this one, 'Come,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." So this centurion is a well-trained man. He obeys orders. When he issues an order, he expects to be obeyed. When he tells his servants to go get him some water, he expects his servant will go get him some water. He is a man under authority, and he respects the authority of Caesar in Rome and of his supervisors in the military. So this guy is a pretty impressive man, and he sees also that Jesus is under authority. And that's what makes Jesus take second take a second look at this man and respect him highly and see that he's genuine. And when Jesus sees that, he marvels. Jesus is marveled by this Roman centurion. Assuredly, I say to you, I've not found such great faith even in Israel. So he says, wow, I really appreciate you, centurion, because I can't find any of my fellow Jews that respect authority. They're all a bunch of radicals and unruly. And so I really respect the authority that you know that you're living under God. And Jesus says, I don't find any of my countrymen that have that kind of great faith. He says, great faith. In other words, the centurion really is trusting God. He doesn't know God very well. But this is pretty interesting that Jesus would speak so highly of him. Mm-hmm. And then Jesus goes on, I say to you that many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, go your way, and as you have believed, so let it be done for you. And his servant was healed that same hour. Jesus did not have to go make a house call.
Who are the sons of the kingdom? That's the.
Well, now, Jesus says there's coming a time when the promised children of Israel are going to gather together for a big festive occasion. And Abraham will be there, and Isaac and Jacob, and they're going to gather in the kingdom of heaven. And it's going to be a big party, a big celebration, but there's an awful lot of my fellow Jews, sons of the kingdom, are going to get thrown out. Professing believers that don't believe in me, hypocrites. Not the original Abraham, Isaac, and Moses, but most everybody that's come afterwards has no interest in Jesus whatsoever. That's going to show up because they eventually killed Jesus. So he says, and so Jesus looks into the future. When this day comes and we have this big supper, this big feast time, there's going to be an awful lot of Jews that show up thinking they're invited to the banquet, and they are going to be thrown out with weeping and gnashing of teeth. And that's pretty awesome. That's the rest of the New Testament confirms this in the long history of Israel and their general disobedience down through the years. But the centurion, and Jesus just says remotely, issues the command that the man be healed, and he's healed the same hour. So we don't know what's wrong with the servant. He was very, very ill, and Jesus has this ability to heal at a distance without checking the patients, without doing a blood test, or without checking his heart rate or anything like that. Be healed. And that's one of the wonderful things about Jesus. We have lost track of healing because it's so such a misused gift. Okay, so we've had a couple of incidents here. Now, after this happens, he's healed the leper, he's healed the centurion's servant without going anywhere. And now he's going back home to Peter's house where he's staying. When Jesus had come into Peter's house, he saw his wife, Peter's mother, lying sick with a fever. And the fevers in that day would be life-threatening. You don't take an antibiotic. You don't just have a lemonade and a nap. So this is a fever that's life-threatening. And she's probably an older woman. And Jesus is very distressed when he comes home to Peter's house, and there is his wife's mother lying sick. He touched her hand, and the fever left her. Then she arose and served them. Did she have to spend a week in bed? No, she got right out of bed. The fever was gone immediately, and she immediately went out and got dinner ready and started serving Jesus and his disciples with him. And they're hungry and tired from working all day with Jesus. And so this dear woman is healed, and she gets up and cooks dinner for them, essentially. When evening had come, so they have late afternoon, and they have something to eat, and they all rest. But once the sun goes down, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. And demon possession is actually pretty common today, although we don't generally recognize it, because that's what happens when you don't pay attention to Jesus for a long period of time and you compromise with sin and with evil. Evil spirits will actually come in and possess people. And deadly, evil, angelic beings actually come and make home inside of people. And these demon-possessed people came over. We don't know how many of them, but a large number of them, they would be psychiatric patients. They'd be mentally ill people. They'd be distressed, but they also wanted to be healed. A lot of mentally ill people don't want to be healed. A lot of people who have emotional problems don't want to get well, because then they don't get pity, and nobody will take care of them, and they got to go to work. But Jesus, he's probably tired. I'd probably like to take an evening off and watch television or play checkers or something, but he can't, because he's got all these people waiting in line outside the house, a little small house. You can go to the place where this house stood and see that it's just a small cottage. But there's a crowd outside the door, and Jesus handles them without a secretary or a nurse, and one at a time, and Jesus talks to them and relates to them and casts out orders the demons to leave them, and they get well. Now, Matthew tells us that this is a fulfillment of what Isaiah the prophet said. He himself took our infirmities and bore our sicknesses. So that's from Isaiah chapter 53, which is about the Messiah. And the Messiah, when he came, Isaiah says 700 years earlier, he himself took our infirmities and bore our sicknesses. And this is a good insight that Jesus actually takes sickness and disease away from us and takes it into himself. So he's an empath. He identifies with the people. He does not shun. He doesn't keep himself insulated with a cap and gown and a sanitary apron. He doesn't insulate himself from the people he's healing. He goes right where they're at. When Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side. So it's getting so crowded and so hectic that Jesus can't even get a night's rest. And it's probably time to go away and get out into the country and get some time alone with the disciples, which is when you're not under the pressure of all the crowds. And so he says to his disciples, hey, let's go. We're getting out of town. And we're going to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is 6 miles across. And they're going to go by boat. And because these guys are fishermen pretty much, and they've got boats. And you can walk around there, but it'd take you several days. Whereas you can row right across. All right? Now we have a little interlude here. A certain scribe came and said to him, Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. So there are people that say, wow, Jesus, you're my teacher, my guru. I'm going to go where you go. I'm going to follow you and hang on every word. And this is some young kid probably. And he's so excited about Jesus that he wants to hang out with Jesus. Let's hang out. So we don't know anything more about this guy. He's a scribe, so he's probably literate, and he probably knows several languages, and he probably can take letters and so on. So he's not just an ordinary kid. And Jesus answers this guy in a very interesting way. He says, Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Well, you can follow me if you want, but I can tell you I do not have a motel room. I don't have an SUV or a Jeep, or I don't even have a sleeping bag. So if you go with me, you're just going to have to take your cloak and scrounge your food.
Rough it.
And you got to rough it big time. And are you sure you want to leave home? Are you sure you want to leave the TV set and all of your creature comforts and go with me? And that's why he says, he quotes this, foxes have holes. Every fox at the end of the day can go crawl into a hole in the ground where mama fox and the babies are there and he can sleep and be cozy. Birds in the air all have nests. The birds are flying around all day long, but at the end of the day, the birds go sit in their nests and take care of their young. And so he says that I am not in the category of foxes and birds. I don't have anywhere to lay my head. This is pretty interesting that the guy who created the whole universe comes to his own people and was not received by his own people, and he has no house, no apartment, no room in a boarding house. He can't live at the brother's house because there's no room for him. The disciples, later on, we find the disciples would go home to their families, and Jesus would go curl up in the Garden of Gethsemane all by himself on a cold winter night. So I don't know whether this guy followed him or not, but he probably did. But there's another disciple. Another one of his disciples said to him, Lord, let me go and bury my father. Well, we don't know if the guy's father's dead or sick or dying. Probably not. But he says, well, Jesus, I'll follow you, but I got to clean up some affairs. I got to tidy up my household, and I got to make a will, and I've got to, my dad's going to die one of these days, and I got to bury him.
Yeah.
Because that's but Jesus said, let the dead bury their own dead. that's ludicrous, because a dead man can't bury himself. Somebody's got to bury your father when he dies, or your spouse or whatever. But Jesus is saying here, following me is so important that you can forget about everything. Take up your cross and follow me. You want to be my disciple, fine, but you can't put any clauses in our agreement that lets you have a way out, okay?
I thought maybe he meant the dead, like the people that are not saved, you know. Like
that's
dead.
Exactly, I think it does mean that.
It means the dead, the ones that are living in this world, you know.
I think that's exactly
dead.
Right, Howard.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly right, because his calling is so much higher that it's completely above and beyond ordinary living. Ordinary obligations to family, to friends, to relatives. Is just, so I think that's right.
Mainly like he's saying, this is so much more important than
this is so much more important. So our commitment to Jesus should be like that. We should be prepared to follow him no matter what we have to give up or forsake or leave behind. Now, he gets into a boat. If you read all four Gospels, you'll find that the events in the Gospels don't always come in the same time sequence. So the Gospels do not always agree. You can't just read this Gospel through and get a continual thread of everything that Jesus did. So what happens next is actually found in Matthew and Mark and Luke. And they're slightly different. And that's why I got out a Harmony of the Gospels, which is a book, you get it online, in which the Gospel accounts are in columns.
Oh, neat.
And we're going to look at this next account, and I will show you that there's a difference in the accounts.
Okay.
But let's just take it at face value.
Okay.
So they get in the boat. So that's fine. Now, this is some great stuff here. he came to his own city. So he gets in the boat from where he was over, and he gets to Capernaum. Capernaum is his own city. So he's out of town when some of these previous events happen. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I've got that wrong, because I've jumped ahead. Verse 23 of chapter 8. When he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. So Jesus has said, I want to cross over the Sea of Galilee tonight. His disciples followed him, and these are seasoned fishermen. They know that storms can come upon the Sea of Galilee in a moment. Winds blow down over the cliffs and stir up this mill pond into a ferocious, turbulent, dangerous sea. And these seasoned fishermen are quite used to that. They go fishing and the wind will come up, be a calm day, and suddenly the sea is torn with waves. This is true to this very day. So these fishermen would not ordinarily be bothered about a storm. A great tempest arose on the sea so that the boat was covered with the waves, and Jesus was asleep. So there are waves breaking over the boat. These are sailing ships. Remember, they had sails. It's pitching and lurching and swaying, and the waves are breaking over the boat. And where is Jesus this whole time? Well, he needs a nap. So he's gone over into the corner of the boat, and he's sleeping down, and he's not the least bit bothered by this. Of all things. So this is a good picture of the fact that during the storms of life, Jesus is not upset. He might even be having a nap. His disciples came to him and woke him, saying, Lord, save us, we're perishing. So, Lord, you got to come and get involved in this great storm, because we're perishing. The ship's going to sink, and we're all going to go down, and we won't be able to finish our time with you. And you'll get drowned too. And Jesus is probably a little annoyed. He needed the sleep. And he doesn't. He assumed that the disciples would have a prayer meeting and ask God for help against the storm. But they don't do that. They wake Jesus up. He said to them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Oh, you guys, why didn't you handle it? He arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So Jesus stood up and took authority over the winds and the sea, two things here, and he probably spoke to angels who were operating behind the scenes that were causing the winds to blow so ferociously and the waves. So in his ability as Lord of the universe, he simply spoke to the winds and the sea, spoke to angels behind these forces in nature, and immediately the angels obeyed, and the winds went down and the sea calmed down. There was a great calm. This is always what happens when you pray and Jesus is involved. A turbulent situation becomes great calm. You have peace about something, whether you have the answer or not. The men marveled, saying, who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey him? So they see another side of Jesus they hadn't seen before. They saw that he could heal and cast out demons and make sick people well. And they did not know that he was the Lord over nature itself, that he had the power with him. Wasn't ostentatious. He didn't showy about this. He didn't brag. But when the situation came up, he was able to cause nature to obey him. So this is just another one of the signs that this Jesus is not an ordinary man. So now they cross the rest of the way over to Gadara. Gadara is, I visited there some years ago, it's on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, and this region is under Gentile control. There are five Gentile cities over there that the Romans have built. And there are no Jews over there. So you're going to get immediately out of Jewish lifestyles and Jewish influence. You're going to come into pagan influence. So Gadara, this is a very important passage. And he comes to the country of the Gergesenes. or the Gadarenes, they're called. And this is a bunch of Gentiles living on the east side of the Sea of Galilee up on a hill. And as he gets out of the boat with his disciples and walks up into the country, two demon-possessed men coming out of the tombs, exceedingly fierce, so that no one could pass that way. So he finds two wild, out-of-control, demon-possessed men raging and furious, and they're living in the tombs. Now, the other Gospels don't say there were two of them. They say there was only one of them, so we don't really know if there was two or one. It's bad enough that there's one. And this poor individual is an outcast, as we can see. And he is possessed by demons, and that means he has to be chained, and he's tormented, and he's dangerous. So you don't want to tangle with him. So the town leaders have locked him up in the tombs and chained him up and tried to restrain him, but that doesn't stop him. Well, Jesus gets out of the boat with his disciples, and they come unto this guy. And what happens is, suddenly they cried out. They, the demons, probably. What have we to do with you, Jesus, you Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? So the demons recognize Jesus immediately, and they cry out, and they know who Jesus is, that he's the Son of God. The demons recognize that, even if nobody else does. And the man that's possessed is not in his right mind, but the demons immediately think that Jesus has come over to torment them ahead of time. In other words, they want comfort and security as long as they can get it. They want to live comfortably in this man. And they know that their inevitable judgment is to be cast into the bottomless pit and tormented. So that's what the fate of a demon is. They are not offered salvation. And when the demon was cast out, the mute spoke. So the presence of this demon or the demons in this man made him unable to speak. So he was mute. He could not, his own personality had been eclipsed and drowned out, and he could not talk. He was not rational. We'd say he was insane or schizophrenic or something, psychotic. He wasn't psychotic. He was possessed by demons. And the moment Jesus asked these demons to leave, we see more about that in a moment, the demons left, and the man was in his right mind immediately. The multitudes, great crowds coming around, now that people have come down from town because of the uproar going on, so it's Jesus and his disciples and the townspeople that are witnessing this, and Jesus orders the demons out of this man, and he comes to his right mind right away, and all the crowd said, it was never seen like this in Israel. He casts out demons by the ruler of the demons, the Pharisees said. So the Pharisees, who are the skeptics, remember, the enemies, they're Jews from Jerusalem, and they are hanging out, they're up there too, and they immediately say, well, Jesus is casting out demons because he works for the devil. So Satan knows how to deal with his own demons. And so Jesus is just in league with the devil here. Well, that's absolutely, completely false. To get the full effect of what's going on here, this is where I reach for the harmony of the Gospels and get the accounts in Mark and Luke. So let me read you the same passage for Mark and then Luke. Mark's gospel says, that day when evening came, he said to his disciples, let us go over to the other side. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. We didn't know that. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." The wind calmed down, died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." I'm going to keep reading Matthew and reading Mark, so you, because this is a little bit, you start getting a lot of information. Mark 5, verse 1. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. The man lived in the tombs. No one could bind him anymore, and not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, and he tore the chains apart, broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills he would cry out and cut himself with stones. Heard of cutting. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice. This is the demon speaking. "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Jesus asked this demon, "What is your name?" And the spirit said, "My name is Legion, for we are many." There's a whole bunch of us living in this guy, not one man. And this demon, the chief demon, begged Jesus again not to send him out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. Pigs are not clean. They're not kosher. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs. Allow us to go with them." Jesus gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 pigs in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off, that be the pig owners who make money off of these pigs, are very upset because they've lost their commerce. And they go into town, and the townspeople want to know what happened, and they all rush out. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told them about the pigs as well. The people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. "Get out of town, Jesus. You're in trouble for all of us. We're all going to be in trouble if you keep hanging out here." As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not allow him, but said, "Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis, in the whole region of 10 Roman cities, how much Jesus has done for him, and the people were all amazed. So this guy was turned into an evangelist, and he's evangelizing the Gentiles by running around town telling everybody what Jesus has done for him. This is the guy that was completely insane and demonized, and he's in his right mind, and he's rational, and so he can go give his personal life story. All right, now I'll go back and do Luke. Luke 8:22. One day, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side of the lake." So they got into a boat and set out. As they sailed, he fell asleep. A squall came down on the lake so that the boat was being swamped, and they were in great danger. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we're going to drown." Jesus got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided and all was calm. "Where is your faith?" he asked his disciples. In fear and amazement, they asked one another, "Who is this? He commands even the winds and the waters, and they obey him." They sailed to the region of the Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes, he's naked, or he had not lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. So this guy is naked, he's ugly, he's dirty and filthy, and he's living in the tombs with dead bodies. So this is pretty bad. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell on his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the evil spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him. And though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. So this guy is tormented, and he's got supernatural strength, which comes from the demon, and police come and chain him, but he breaks the chains. So this guy has got supernatural strength. Jesus asked the man, Jesus comes right up to this guy and says, "Hey, what's your name?" Which is pretty awesome. "Hey, tell me your name, where are you from?" This is pretty, you'd ask that of anybody. You meet somebody that's in a difficult situation, say, "Hey, first of all, tell me your name. Tell me a little bit about yourself." And the man said, "Legion," because he's not talking to the man, he's talking to the chief demon. Many demons had gone into him, and they, the demons, begged him repeatedly not to order them out to go into the abuso, into the abyss. That comes up in the Bible a lot. The abyss, the bottomless pit, is the perpetual home where the devil and the demons get cast eventually. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into the pigs, and Jesus gave them permission. He said, "Okay, you demons, you can go into the pigs." And these demons obeyed Jesus. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned.
Is that where they came up with a swine lake?
Swine lake? No. Yeah. No, this is where you get
Ray Simmons made some
this is where
game.
You get deviled ham, though. You heard of deviled ham?
No, Ray Simmons would say some jokes.
That's what Ray Simmons says. Now, this man, who had been tormented for years, and naked and dirty and unkempt and out of control, is sane and rational, and he's himself. The people went out to see what happened. They came to Jesus. They found the man from whom the demons had gone out, sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed in his right mind. So he put clothes on. He put on a clean set of clothes. He's sitting quietly, reading his Bible on the hillside. The guy is completely normal. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. All the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. He got into the boat and left. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him. "Jesus, take me with you. I want to be one of your disciples. I want to follow you. I want to learn all about you." And Jesus said, "No, you stay here because I want you to start telling the people in this Gentile town who I am." So he gets to be the first evangelist here, this guy. Don't know his name, meet him someday. "Return home and tell how much God has done for you," or how much Jesus has done for you. So the man went away and told all over town how much Jesus had done for him. Well, you can see that you need to put all these three accounts together and sort of massage them, because these are eyewitness reports by Matthew and Mark and Luke, and they're there, and they're writing this down years later, and they don't all have exactly the same narrative. So I wanted to take this one scene here and sort of show you that the importance of seeing what the other Gospels say about this same incident. So we can agree on the essentials here. Okay?
Lambert, there was one verse here that I know that I used in the past. It's typically whenever someone will say that they are a Christ believer, but then they really have no fruits of being a Christ believer. And I'll point them to this verse here where it says, "What have we to do with you, Jesus, Son of God?" So the demons, you know, recognize that this is Jesus Christ.
Yeah, they will.
But they have nothing to do with him.
That's right.
And here in James chapter 2, 19, "You believe that there is one God, you do well, even the demons believe."
Oh, yeah.
The demons believe and tremble. And that's because the demons know who Jesus is, and they know their ultimate fate, and they are not offered salvation. And so that's one thing we have. When we meet some people that are demon influenced, they may agree with us point by point by point, but that does not mean that the person has received Jesus. You could be talking to a demon. And the demons know who Jesus is, and if Jesus orders the demons out, they have to leave. And Jesus, in this case, is rescuing one man from the influence of many years of being demon-possessed, and the end result is a changed life, a transformed life, changed behavior, changed demeanor, and the guy is talking openly about knowing Jesus. So that's a very good point to keep in mind here, because we get this direct encounter with supernatural entities who are fully aware of God and invisible realities, which we people, human beings, don't know. Chapter 9. "So he got in the boat and crossed over and came to his own city." So the next day or a couple of days later, Jesus gets back in the same boat with his disciples, maybe several boats, and they sail 6 miles across westward to Capernaum. And no sooner do they get back than the crowds gather around Jesus again. "Behold, they brought to him a paralytic lying in a bed. Jesus, seeing their faith, said to the paralytic, 'Son, be of good cheer, your sins are forgiven you.'" Well, the guy didn't ask to have his sins forgiven, he asked to be healed of his paralysis. Well, they're some probably related in some way or another. Jesus does not deal immediately with the paralysis, he deals with the man's forgiveness of his sins. And we can assume that the paralytic was healed as a result of that, since knowing Jesus generally changes our physical health, maybe not instantly. So the symptoms were the guy was paralyzed, couldn't walk, and he has to be carried around by his friends on a litter or in a wheelchair or whatever the equivalent is. He can't walk. We don't know how old he was. And Jesus calls him son. Not all sickness is a result of sin. Only once in a while is sin the cause behind somebody getting sick or being paralyzed or being born blind or whatever. So we can't rush to judgment just because somebody's not well. We can't say, oh, that's the demon. We can't just naively deal with the symptoms. And in this case, Jesus knows what the underlying issue is. The underlying issue is that this guy is not trusting Jesus for some reason or other. And that's where Jesus goes right to the heart. "Be of good cheer, your sins are forgiven you." That's just an absolute direct intrusion of Jesus into this guy's life. At once, some of the scribes hanging out with Jesus said to themselves, "This man blasphemes." So the cynicism in these scribes, they're educated too much, they know too much, they're too smart. "This man blasphemes." This man is claiming to be God or to serve God, And nobody can do that. So this guy is insulting God. So they are out and out denying what Jesus, who he is and what he's doing. So that's what blasphemy is, an out and out denial of Jesus when the evidence is totally contradictory to that. And we get more and more of this in the Gospels as we find that Jesus is insulted and blasphemed repeatedly and rejected, eventually scourged and crucified. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said to the scribes, "Why do you think evil in your hearts? Why do you believe the worst when I am doing good and healing people and making them well? Don't you guys even have any compassion at all for this man or this person? And you just bring up the issue of whether God's with me or not. And the bottom line is people are getting changed and made well, and I care about them." So that ought to shut him up. It doesn't. "Which is easier, to say your sins are forgiven you, or say rise up and walk? But that you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins," he said to the paralytic, "Arise, take up your bed and go to your house." And the man arose and departed to his house. When the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God who had given such power to men. So to prove a point, Jesus, having healed this man on the inside, now proceeds to heal him physically on the spot. And the man gets up and walks. He probably never walked. He muscles atrophied. He got up and walked, and everybody could see that he was new inside and out. And Jesus admits that this is proof of his power to heal a whole person. Because when the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God who had given such power to men. Okay? Now we're going to get a very interesting incident here. When the Romans were ruled over Israel, they had tax collectors everywhere. Tax collectors were very, very unpopular men. Jesus comes across this particular tax collector who has a booth set up on the highway, and this tax collector is charging toll for the use of the Roman highway, probably. And so the tax collectors had a bad reputation because they cheated and they were dishonest and they'd levy harsh taxes. And so they would not let somebody use the Roman road until they had paid exorbitant taxes. So tax collectors are very...
They probably got a share of it or something.
Yeah, that's right. So Jesus is walking along this road from Galilee, and he comes across a guy named Matthew. And Matthew is a tax collector. He's a Jew. His name means gift of God. And Jesus says, doesn't stop and interview Matthew. He doesn't stop and check him out. He doesn't ask for his passport, his birth certificate, his credentials, what school he went to, what he's got a degree from. He just says, "Hey, follow me, Matthew." And Matthew stops what he's doing and starts to follow Jesus and becomes the author of this gospel because he becomes one of the disciples of Jesus. And this is where we meet him here, really. So Matthew, who wrote this gospel, would have had to get everything that precedes this from one of the other disciples because he wasn't an eyewitness, and he's stepping into the picture right here. And he's a new follower of Jesus. So it was. Now, the next thing that Matthew does is says, "Come over to my house for dinner tonight." And Matthew's rich. He's got a nice house because he's living off of all of these exorbitant taxes. And the tax collectors are highly despised. And no legitimate Jew would go ever have dinner with a tax collector. It was just not done. It was not kosher. But Jesus accepts a dinner invitation from Matthew, his new disciple, to go have dinner. Jesus sat at the table in the house, and many tax collectors and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. So Jesus So Matthew rounds up his fellow tax collectors. The Roman tax collector says, hey, look, I'm having dinner for a few friends tonight, and this guy, Jesus, is going to be a guest at my house for dinner. And so bring your friends and come over. So the tax collectors all come into town. And by the way, the disciples are tagging along. And then there's a lot of sinners, a lot of plain notorious sinners like prostitutes or ladies of the night or disreputable people who were notorious sinners coming to dinner too. So Matthew has this big party. And this is probably his lifestyle here. It's what he does. You can imagine this setting. And Jesus is a guest at the table. So he's not up at the head of the table where Matthew is. He's down at the lower part of the table, and the disciples are there, so he's a guest. And he's allowing this to happen. So Jesus is happy to go sit down with tax collectors and sinners. And the disciples are outraged, who is this man who eats with tax collectors and sinners? No decent, God-fearing Jew would ever eat with tax collectors and hang out with sinners, with lowlife. No way. And then Jesus heard all this bickering and conversation going on at the dinner, and he says, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. That's a profound saying. If you're well, you don't go to the doctor. It's when you're sick, you go to the doctor, and he says, by the way, I came to call sinners to repentance, so go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. The righteous would be here, the self-righteous. I didn't come to save the people that already got their act together, that are already righteous. Yeah.
Just like the church is not a mausoleum for saints, it's a hospital for sinners.
That's it. The church is not a mausoleum for saints, but a hospital for sinners. It's perfect, yeah. Howard. Perfect. And the word righteous can mean somebody who has faith in Jesus, but in this context, it's really the self-righteous, the people that are self-satisfied. So, this is, must have been a real interesting dinner situation. The disciples of John, that's John the Baptist, whose cousin, came to him, Jesus. Why do you and the Pharisees fast often and your disciples don't fast? So John the Baptist down around Jerusalem is still baptizing and calling people to repent. And they're austere in their lifestyles, and these disciples of John the Baptist come up and say, hey, Jesus, your lifestyle here in Galilee seems to be a lot different than the austere lifestyles that we've been living with John the Baptist, your cousin. What goes? What gives here? Jesus answers, can the friends of the bridegroom mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast. So Jesus says, well, the bridegroom is here now as himself, and this is like a marriage, or this is a festive time of joy and happiness, and it's temporary because I'm not going to be here with you guys permanently. So the next thing he says is, no one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. The patch pulls away from the garment. The tear is made worse. If you have a coat or a pair of pants or something that rips, you go put a patch on it. My mother used to do this. You take a piece of new cloth and you sew it on over the tear. And the trouble is that the rate at which your pants shrink versus the patch shrinks generally pulls the patch off. So if you're going to patch an old tear in your shirt or your pants, you don't get brand new cloth, you patch it with the old cloth. Nor do people put new wine into old wineskins, or else the wineskins break. The wine is spilled and the wineskins are ruined, but they put new wine into new wineskins and both are preserved. So this is true that wine skins were leather, and they get dried out and they crack and they wouldn't hold wine anymore. And if you got fresh new wine, you don't put it in an old, leaky old wineskin. You get a new wineskin for it. Well, the wine is a picture of joy. So you don't try to put Jesus into a old wineskin. You put Jesus into a new wineskin. That means you change your lifestyle and you clean up your act. And, because the new wine and the new wineskins will be perfectly safe. Now we have another. It's a whole series of incidents. While he spoke these things to them, behold, a ruler came and worshipped him. This would be a Jewish authority. My daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she will live. Jesus arose and followed him, and so did his disciples. And on the way, suddenly a woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years came from behind and touched the hem of his garment. She said to herself, if only I may touch his garment, I should be made well. Jesus turned around, and when he saw her, he said, be of good cheer, daughter. Your faith has made you well. The woman was made well from that hour. In that society, there were some women that had a perpetual flow of menstrual blood. Their menstrual cycle did not come and go like it should. It didn't shut off. So these women were bleeding all the time. And that meant they were unclean all the time, and it meant that they were not acceptable in the community. If anybody knew, they would be shunned. So this is some kind of an illness that can't be cured. I don't know what it's called in modern medicine, but this poor woman was desperate. She did not want to go confront Jesus. She said to herself, if only I can run up and touch the hem of his garment, the hem of his robe. The hem is where the power is supposed to reside. So she does not even want to have an encounter with Jesus. But Jesus immediately gives her compassion and understanding. And be of good cheer, daughter, your faith has made you well. He calls her daughter. So that means he's happy to know her. He's happy to help her. And he's healing her years and years of embarrassment and infirmity and disgrace. Right there on the spot. When Jesus came into the ruler's house, he's on his way to the ruler's house, and to help the guy whose his son is dying. No, his daughter has just died, so the ruler came to Jesus and wants Jesus to restore his daughter, and then, who's dead. When Jesus came into the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd wailing, you hired professional mourners in those days. You'd have somebody come and play the flute and some mourners to cry and weep as you had a funeral. This is true in weddings and funerals in Egypt they've been to. You make sure that somebody cries enough over a dead body. You hire some professional wailers. And they come in and cry and mourn and play their flutes, and the whole town knows how sorry you are that your loved one has died. But the girl is dead. Jesus said to them, make room. The girl is not dead. She's sleeping. And they laughed him to scorn. Ha, 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 Jesus, who the heck do you think you are? She's as dead as a doornail. Look at here. We've got the whole funeral underway. Her body is cold. She's as dead as people get to be. And you come along and you think she's only sleeping? Oh, let me tell you something, Jesus. You don't know what you're talking about. We've been burying people for years. We know when dead is dead and when sleep is sleep. Jesus said to them, make room. The girl is not dead but sleeping. They laughed at him to scorn. When the crowd was put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl arose from the dead, and the report of this went out into all the land. So he throws all these people out of the house, and he takes this dead girl's hand, and he speaks to her, and takes her hand and lifts her up from the dead, and she comes back to life. And so right away, this girl is back in good health, and her father is not, need not be concerned anymore. And the town has no answer for this, except to spread the news. Guess what happened in our town today? So this is amazing what Jesus does. When Jesus departed from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, "Son of Man, have mercy on us." When he had come into the house, the blind men came to him. Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I'm able to do this?" Two blind men. And he asked them, "Do you believe that I'm able to heal your blindness?" Well, that never happens in medical science. It just doesn't take place. And there's two of them, there's not one. They said, "Yes, Lord." And that means they recognize Jesus as the Lord, so they're not unbelievers. "According to your faith, so be it to you." So here he links their ability to trust him with the restoration of their eyesight. Their eyes were opened. Jesus sternly warned them, seeing that no one knows it. Hey, look, keep this quiet. You can't keep quiet the fact you've been blind all your life and suddenly you're seeing and walking around and taking in the creation and seeing people and able to navigate. So how can you possibly shut up? When they had departed, they spread the news about him in all the country. That's going to have a bad effect long term, because it's going to get down to Jerusalem that Jesus is doing these crazy things. And the officials have got to come and find out and get rid of this troublemaker. As he went out, behold, they brought to him a man mute and demon-possessed. When the demon was cast out, the mute, the man who couldn't speak, said, and the crowd multiplied, "It has never been like this in Israel." Well, it had been like that in Israel in times of Elijah and Elisha. They just didn't remember their history, that Jehovah regularly healed diseases and cast out demons in their history. And they just didn't realize that Jesus was one of a long line of prophets. Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. When he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. He said to his disciples, "The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers to his harvest." So when Jesus saw the enormous needs of the hour, and he saw that he was only one man dealing with thousands and thousands of people, he only has so many hours in the day, he only has so much time and energy, and he's carried away with compassion for the lost. And that's when he begins to bring his disciples into this ministry, as we see next week. The harvest is plentiful and the laborers are few. And so out there in the world today, there are thousands and thousands of people who need to know Jesus, and they're waiting for somebody to come and heal them and bring them the news. And we are short-handed. There aren't very many of us, and Jesus knows that he himself is limited, and it's not good that there should only be one Jesus in one time and one place in history. So his strategy is to make himself available through his followers. And that means everywhere you have a Christian, you have Jesus. Everywhere you have Jesus, you have the answer to this urgent need of the hour. So we are the fulfillment of this grand plan that Jesus put into effect 2,000 years ago, and it's moved by compassion, the compassion and love of Jesus for the lost, and his desire that no one should perish, and his mercy, and that completely overrules the legalism and the authorities in the church or the synagogue. It just bypasses all that. And it goes right to the heart of the problem, is that Jesus loves everybody. He does not want anybody to perish. And our unavailability, it handicaps Jesus. That you might say that we, it doesn't stop Jesus from getting his work done, but we often stand in his way. So that's chapters 9 and 10. And you can see how jam-packed it is and how worthwhile it is for...
8 and 9.
Huh?
8 and 9. 8 and 9. You said 9 and 10.
8 and 10. 9. Chapters 8 and 9. Okay, thank you. No questions, Dave? Okay. I think this is exciting. Reading this,